As I said in the email that we sent out, we're going to continue in the Kings today. And we're going to finish off chapter 17 and then get in through the majority of chapter 18, dealing with Elijah and Ahab and the events that took place there. And we're going to go back to where we finished last week, or conclude where we finished last week, in 1 Kings 17:17-24. Now, what had just happened before that is Isaiah had gone to Zarephath. Elijah had gone to Zarephath after the brook Cherith had dried up. And again, we talked that, you know, God could have easily kept the ravens coming during the whole time of the drought. He could have kept that brook running as long as he wanted to, but he wanted to change the venue of Elijah, and he told her to go to Zarephath and that there would be a widow there. And he went and met her. She was just about out of food. And Elijah said, "Please give me some food." She said, "This is all I have." Elijah said, that's about four times in a row. Elijah said, "You give it to me, God's going to keep it coming." And she believed Elijah and did it. And God provided. It said he provided for many days. And so as they were eating that food and the oil, the next thing that happens is more severe to the woman and her son. Verse 17. Now it happened that after these things, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became sick, and his condition became very grave, until at the end he was no longer breathing. So she said to Elijah, "Why is my business any of yours, you man of God? Yet you have come to me to bring wrongdoing, to bring my wrongdoing to remembrance, and to put my son to death." But he said to her, "Give me your son." Then he took him from her arms and carried him up to the upstairs room where he was living and laid him on his own bed. Now, I just thought, I mean, we don't have any idea how old this son was, but I get the impression he was not very old, because Elijah picked him up in his arms and carried him upstairs. So we don't have any idea, except he wasn't a grown man at that point in time. And verse 20, and he called out to the Lord and said, "Lord, my God, have you also brought catastrophe upon the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die?" Then he stretched himself out over the boy three times and called to the Lord and said, "Lord, my God, please let this boy's life return to him." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the boy returned to him, and he revived. Elijah then took the boy and brought him down from the upstairs room to the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son is alive." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." Quite a story. So after the provisions were sustained and Elijah had told her that God would provide, this more grave or equally grave situation came about, and her son became sick and died and stopped breathing. And when this happened, even Elijah questioned the Lord about why. Why did you bring me here to have this happen? But he didn't stop there. He just didn't go, "Oh, why did this happen?" and wring his hands and moan. But he acted in verses 21 and 22, and God restored the boy's life. Now, one thing to note is that this woman and her son, these miracles were done for people who were not Jewish. These people lived in Phoenicia, outside of Israel. And another thing we need to note, it was not the way that Elijah acted that carried the power to raise the boy from the back to life. It wasn't the power of Elijah. I'm waiting for one of these crazy charismatic type churches, you know, the Bethel thinks they can raise someone from the dead. So, well, you got to go lay on the guy that's dead for, you know, three times. I'm waiting for them to do something stupid like that, because it would be absolutely silly. It was because God heard Elijah's plea and answered that plea. This shows that Yahweh is God, not Baal. He was in Phoenicia where they worshipped Baal. And this shows that God had power over life, not Baal. We already have seen with the drought that God controls the weather. And then we see that God controls the provisions for this woman and Elijah and both at the brook and in Zarephath. And now we see that God controls life itself. He alone has the ability to provide and to take away. He took away the rain. He provides the rain. No one else can do that. And the result is that the woman, and we're not even told her name, she understood. She ended up in verse 24. Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. What was the result? She understood that God is truth. And what she was seeing around her in Phoenicia was not truth. And Elijah stayed there until God directed him to move away, which took over 3 years from the time that the drought started until he went back and met Ahab again. Now, we're not told how long Elijah was at the brook. Was it a month? Was it 6 months? Was it a year and a half? We have no idea. And we're not told how long he was at Zarephath with this woman and her son, and God provided for them there. But the total is 3 years plus a little bit. And now God is ready to act. And we see that next, starting in 1 Kings 18. I can get that to come up right. There we go. So we go to 1 Kings 18, and this chapter begins, "Now it happened after many days," again, we don't know how long, "that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, 'Go present yourself to Ahab, and I will provide rain on the face of the earth.'" So in this time of 3 to 3.5 years of drought, God has come to Elijah and said, "I'm ready to end it. I'm ready to bring rain." So God makes it known that He is the one who will provide the rain. He provided the ravens to bring the meat to Elijah and the water in the brook. He provided the flour and the oil for Elijah and the woman and her son, and He provided the life for her son. Now, I want to depart from this just a little bit. I mean, just go on a little rabbit trail. "I will provide rain on the face of the earth." And I ask myself this question: are events like rain, drought, earthquakes, volcanoes, just a result of nature? if we listen to the message given by groups like the National Geographic and places like that, that's exactly what they want us to believe. That all such natural activities have no ultimate direction. That's just the way the universe works. But what's the Bible say? We can go to Exodus chapter 9, verse 23. It says, "And the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt." In Leviticus 26, verse 4, it says, "Then I shall give you rains in their season, so that the land will yield its produce, and the trees of the field will bear their fruit." In Deuteronomy 11:14, "That he will provide rain for your land in its season, the early and the late rain, so that you may gather your grain, your new wine, and your oil." Job chapter 5, verse 10, "He gives rain on the earth and sends water to the fields." In Psalm 147, 7 to 9, "Sing to the Lord with thanksgiving." We're going to get there in Psalms here in a year or so. "Sing to the Lord with thanksgiving. Sing praises to our God on the lyre. It is He who covers the heavens with clouds, who provides rain for the earth, who makes grass sprout on the mountains. It is He who gives an animal its food and feeds young ravens that cry." It's so easy to fall into the mindset of our day that we created global warming. And Mother Nature acts randomly to do what she does. God has set in motion the things that work. But God's in total control of all of that. We need to fight that thought. We can do things that add to warmth. If we burn all the forests down and everything, yeah. But God's still in control of everything with nature. He's the one that brings rain. He's the one who makes grass sprouts. He controls everything, even the weather. So when earthquakes happen or tornadoes or hurricanes, all that stuff, God can stop it. God can create it. But we have gone so far away from that in our culture today. I was thinking about that, and we just a month ago celebrated Thanksgiving. And so I went out to the first presidential proclamation of Thanksgiving. It was done in 1789, and I want to see the difference here. Next to this is the quote, this is part of the proclamation. "Next to be devoted by the people," that he's talking about next, meaning next Thursday, "will be devoted by the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be, that we may then all unite in rendering unto him our sincere and humble thanks for his kind care and protection of the people of this country previous to their becoming a nation, for the signal and manifold mercies and the favorable interpositions of his providence." Now, George Washington was not a Christian. Okay? He wasn't a believer. There's nothing to indicate that he was. But he did understand that God provided. Okay? You go to 2016. This is from the declaration made 4 years ago. "As a national day of thanksgiving, I encourage the people of the United States to join together, whether in our homes, places of worship, community centers, or any place of fellowship for friends and neighbors," obviously pre-COVID-19, "and give thanks for all we have received in the past year, express appreciation to all those lives, enrich our own, and share our bounty with others." God isn't even mentioned. The closest thing comes to God is places of worship, is as close as it gets. So what we have gone from is a people that understand that it is God who provides the rain. It is God who gives that makes the grass sprouts. It is God who gives an animal its food and feeds the young ravens that cry, to all that everybody's helped each other, and so we're all good here. They've taken God totally out of this equation. And that's what our world is like today. You could call it practical atheism if you wanted to. Back to 1 Kings 18. So God speaks to Elijah. He says, it's time to bring the famine to an end. Now, I've got to think that when Elijah heard that, he got excited. Whoa! Because, I mean, it's been difficult for everyone. And once he heard the news, verse 2, so Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. He wasn't like Jonah. I don't want to go to see Ahab. No, he said, okay, let's go. But then in verse 2 it says, now the famine was severe in Samaria. Now we need to remember also that the drought that God brought was a direct attack on the power of Baal. Baal worshippers taught that Baal made the rain as the storm god, and that Baal was responsible for the agricultural crop. But as we will see, that there's going to be a more direct confrontation to the god of Ahab and Jezebel, and that's going to take place. Ahab's worshiping of Baal was the reason why God brought this drought in the first place. And instead of turning to God for repentance, Ahab didn't do that. Instead, he went to the head of his household to search throughout the land to try to find some grass. We're going to read that starting in verse 3. But by sending Elijah to Ahab, God was giving Ahab yet another chance to repent and turn to him. Ahab caused the drought. When Elijah confronted him, Ahab could have fallen on his knees and said, I did this. Verse 3. So after God told Elijah to go to Ahab, and that the famine was severe, we see what Ahab was doing. Ahab summoned Obadiah, who was in charge of the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, and we don't have any indication or any information on that other than this, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them in by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Then Ahab said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs of water and all the river valleys. Perhaps we will find grass and keep the horses and mules alive and not have to kill some of the cattle. So they divided the land between them to survey it. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. So, before Elijah met Ahab, he's going to meet Obadiah, who is a follower of God. And Obadiah's name, by the way, means servant of the Lord. Now, this is not the same Obadiah who wrote the book Obadiah. They lived a long ways apart from each other. But this was a high-ranking servant of Ahab who was in charge of the household. Now, this gives us a little insight into Ahab. Obadiah was a person who, it says, feared the Lord greatly. MacArthur wrote this. This is, Obadiah was a trusted servant within the home of Jezebel, a woman who hated God's people to the point that she murdered his prophets. It demonstrates that the Lord is placing his servants wherever he chooses, even under the nose of his enemies. And those who worked with him would have known that he feared the Lord. Ahab would have known that he feared the Lord. Now, we don't know how many prophets Jezebel murdered, but the fact that Obadiah harbored 100 of them kind of indicates that Jezebel got rid of a lot of them. I would think more than 100, but we have no idea. Now, the area around Mount Carmel also had many, many caves, so they could go and hide them in these caves. So Ahab knew that Obadiah was not a Baal worshiper, and he was still in charge of his household. So we have Obadiah, who feared the Lord, but was serving a Baal worshiper, and a Baal worshiper who was seeking assistance from one who feared the Lord. Now, another insight we have with Ahab here is that he had enough trust in Obadiah to say, you go this way, I'll go this way. He trusted Obadiah that he would do what he asked. So in verse 7, Obadiah leaves to go his way. It says, now when Obadiah was on his way, behold, Elijah met him. And he recognized him and fell on his face and said, is it you, Elijah, my master? And he said to him, it is I. Go say to your master, behold, Elijah is here. But he said, what sin have I committed that you are handing your servant over to Ahab to put me to death? Surely as the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom to which my master has not sent word to search for you. And whenever they say he is not here, he makes the kingdom or nation swear that they could not find you. Ahab was looking for Elijah this whole time. Yet you are now saying, go say to your master, behold, Elijah is here. And it will come about that when I leave you, that the Spirit of the Lord will carry you to where I do not know. So when I come and inform Ahab that he cannot find you, he will kill me, though I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. So he's saying, I'll go tell Ahab you're here, and then you're going to go run off again and can't be found. Has it not been reported to my master what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, that I hid 100 prophets of the Lord by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water? So Ahab knew what he had done. Yet now you are saying, go say to your master, behold, Elijah is here. Then he will kill me. Then Elijah said, as surely as the Lord of armies lives, before whom I stand, I will certainly present myself to him today. I'm not running away. I came to present myself to Ahab. Don't worry about me, you go running. The first thing we need to look at here is Obadiah recognized Elijah. How, we're not told, but he knew who Elijah was. And when he saw Elijah, he fell on his face before Elijah. He paid homage to him. And he understood that Elijah came with a word from God. Now, when Elijah tells Obadiah to go to Ahab, Obadiah thinks this is his death sentence. Ahab had been fervently trying to find Elijah. As we saw in verse 10, there is no nation or kingdom to which my master has not sent word to search for you. And whenever they say he is not here, he makes the kingdom or nation swear that they could not find you. He was looking, but he hadn't looked at the person's house in Zarephath, and he hadn't looked at the brook Cherith, at least while Elijah was there. So now Obadiah thinks that Ahab would kill him. Maybe thinking because, well, you know, you went and hid 100 prophets, we know that, but now you're hiding Elijah. But even with the initial fear that Obadiah had in going to Ahab, after hearing from Elijah, in verse 15. Then Elijah said, "As surely as the Lord of armies lives before whom I stand, I will certainly present myself to him today." Obadiah said, "Okay, I believe you. Your word's good. I'm going." He didn't run away. Verse 16. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and informed him. Then Ahab went to meet Elijah. So he had no qualms about going to Ahab and telling him, once he knew that Elijah was really going to do that. Now I imagine this was quite a meeting. 3+ years earlier, Elijah said, "Ahab, you got a drought because you have not honored God." And guess what? The drought came. Now MacArthur makes the point that, and until I read what he said, I hadn't thought about this. He said, so Obadiah went to Ahab and informed him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. MacArthur makes the point that that Ahab went to meet Elijah was very unusual. People went to kings. Kings didn't go to people. But here, Ahab went to Elijah. That would show that he knew Elijah was that Elijah was a prophet from God, because Elijah caused this drought in Ahab's mind. And he was not on his haughty, high, kingly horse saying, "No, he's got to come to me." Ahab went. So Obadiah told him where Elijah was, and so Ahab went to meet them. And of course, what happened? I wonder what was going through Ahab's mind when he went to meet Elijah. We do see a few things from the narrative. First thing he did in verse 17 is he blamed Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is this you, the cause of disaster to Israel?" Isn't this typical human behavior? Shifting blame is something we all have a tendency to do. Just watch some 3-year-olds play. And you know what? We do it as 30-year-olds, as 60-year-olds, and 90-year-olds. There's a word that we used to use at work. Maybe you've used it before. Blame shifting. All right? Let's just shift the blame. And that's what Ahab was trying to do. But the blame really and solely rests on Ahab's shoulders. It is Ahab who had disobeyed God, mostly by his worshiping Baal. And Elijah was having none of Ahab's blame on him, and immediately he responded back. Verse 18, he said, "I have not brought disaster to Israel, but you and your father's house have, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and you have followed the Baals." That's why. As we covered it earlier, God hates false worshipers. He hates it when people worship false gods. It's an extremely serious offense to God. And Elijah had absolutely no qualms about challenging Ahab and what he had been doing in worshiping Baal. I mean, he just goes right at the jugular. And with that, he issues a command to Ahab. He doesn't say, "Hey, you know, I think there's a good idea." He says, "No, Ahab, this is what you're going to do." So, Elijah had taken control of the situation. God, through Elijah, had. He said, verse 19, "Now then, send orders and gather me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal, and 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." Now, Elijah knew that there was these 850 prophets. That's a lot of prophets. 850 of them. And he said, bring all Israel as well and go to Mount Carmel. Now, it's interesting that Ahab did what Elijah asked. He brought the prophets of Baal and the Asherah to Mount Carmel. And not only the prophets, but the people came as well. He did everything that Elijah told him to do. And he did so without even knowing what Elijah was planning. Because Elijah doesn't tell him what he's planning until all the people and all the prophets had gathered. Maybe Ahab was in the state of mind that he was going to do anything to end this drought, because it said earlier in verse 2, the drought was severe. And when you get a person to the place that all hope is gone, they're going to try anything. And so Ahab said, okay, I'll do whatever you ask. Verse 20, so Ahab sent orders among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel, or Carmel. Now, Mount Carmel is a range of mountains that's rather than a single peak. It's known as a place of lush trees. Perhaps God, through Isaiah, selected this area for the showdown because it was a fruitful area. It was the area where there was a lot of vegetation. It was an area of perceived strength for Baal. Well, I'm going to go to where, you know, I'm going to go to the fruited plain or the fruited mountains. And then in verse 21, Isaiah approached all the people. Elijah approached all the people. And he said in verse 21, how long are you going to struggle with two choices? If the Lord is God, follow Him. If Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him so much as a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I alone am left as a prophet of the Lord, while Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now give us two oxen, and have them choose one ox for themselves to cut up and place it on the wood. Put no fire on it, under it, and I will prepare the other ox and lay it on the wood, and I will not put a fire under it. Then you will call on the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, He is God. Then the people replied and said, that's a good idea. So in these verses, Elijah tells all that were in attendance what the challenge was, and it was readily accepted. And in verse 21, it says, how long are you going to struggle? And the word literally means to limp. The same word is also used in verse 26 when the prophets were dancing about, limping, trying to get Baal to respond to their requests. So Elijah was asking them, how long will you limp between Baal and Yahweh God? They were trying to serve two gods. They were trying to do a little bit of both. It wasn't that they had totally abandoned God in their minds. They were trying to serve two masters or do both things. In verse 21, we read, but the people did not answer him so much a word. Well, why not? It really shows their spiritual lack of desire to follow God. They were willing to follow any God. They were willing to follow two gods. And then after Elijah told them of his plan, and after hearing it, the people said, oh, that's a good idea. I get the sense that they really didn't care which God responded. Well, if Baal responds with fire, we're good. We're worshiping Baal. If God responds, we're good. We're worshiping Him. As long as they had water and prosperity, they would be happy with any God to lead them. What a sorry place to be. But you know, this is so much like today, it's not even funny. One of the most impactful books I have ever read outside of the Bible is a book called How Should We Then Live, written in the early 1980s by Francis Schaeffer. And in this book, Francis Schaeffer wrote this on page 227. And boy, if this doesn't sound like the time of Elijah, and he wrote this in 1980-something. Quote, "I believe the majority of the silent majority, young and old, will sustain the loss of liberties without raising their voices as long as their own lifestyles are not threatened. And since personal peace and affluence are so often the only values that count with the majority, politicians know that to be elected they must promise these things. Politics has largely become not a matter of ideals. Increasingly, men and women are not stirred by the values of liberty and truth, but of supplying a constituency with a frosting of personal peace and affluence. They know that voices will not be raised as long as people have these things, or at least an illusion of them." That is today. That is today. And he wrote this almost 40 years ago. And then, if you go back to, this is again going down another little rabbit hole, but I think it's worth going to. A man named Edward Gibbon wrote the book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, in the late 1700s. And he wrote this, "Five attributes marked Rome at its end." Now, this was written in 1780-ish time frame. Five attributes marked Rome at its end. One, a mounting love of show and luxury. Number two, a widening gap between the very rich and the very poor. Number three, an obsession with sex. Four, freakishness in the arts, masquerading as originality and enthusiasms pretending to be creativity. And five, an increased desire to live off the state. That is pretty parallel to what we see now today, too. Both of those things, that's what we have. But how's that apply to this? Well, this is where the people were here too. They didn't care who was God. They wanted their water back, and they wanted to be able to plant and grow crops and live and not have a drought. So they didn't care. And Elijah's challenge is heard by all the people and accepted. And this was going to be a clear demonstration of which God was the true God. Now, I had this in my crazy thought. What if you had Baal and Molech represented, and God was not one of the two gods? Who knows? They could be still there calling for the fire to come down, because neither one of them were God. But one of them was the true God, so we don't have to worry about that. So the next thing we have, and we're not going to get all the way through this if you probably figured that out today, but we're going to get a ways, is God's victory at Mount Carmel, starting in verse 25. "So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, 'Choose the one ox for yourself and prepare it first, since there are many of you, and call upon the name of your God, and put no fire under the ox.' So they took the ox which was given them, and they prepared it, and they called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped about the altar which they had made, and at noon, it's been going on for a while, and at noon, Elijah ridiculed them and said, Call out with a loud voice, since he is a god. Undoubtedly, he is attending to business, or is on the way, or on a journey. Perhaps, maybe he's asleep, and will awaken. So they cried out with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until blood gushed out on them. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. So they began the day's events early, and they kept going and going and going till noon, and then afternoon, until all the way to the evening sacrifice. 450 people doing this, screaming and yelling and cutting themselves. And you know what? These 850 prophets, they were sincere. They were sincere. And they had to be getting tired too. One thing to note is sincerity doesn't count. Truth counts. I remember talking to a Mormon missionary one time, and I was asking them questions. They had an older man probably in his 60s, about my age now, and a young guy. And I was asking him questions, and the older guy put me aside. And he says, You shouldn't ask these questions, because this guy over here, he's young, and it might really confuse him, because he's really sincere in what he believes. So what? You don't think those guys were sincere who flew the planes into the World Trade Center? You bet they're sincere. You don't think the people that live up in Tibet, you know, with these guys, they're sincere. But so what? Sincerity doesn't count. Truth counts. And we can look at all who are duped by false religions. They try hard. They try hard. They're sincere. But they believe in a false religious system because they believe in something that's not true. Truth is important. And so these 850 prophets tried vainly again and again to get a response from their God. Then Elijah wasn't shy about mocking them. During their attempt to get Baal to do anything, they resorted to actions that were not uncommon in pagan worship activities, with cutting themselves and making them bleed. They self-lacerated themselves to get a response, to get pity from Baal. But such attempts are forbidden, by the way. Those types of actions are forbidden in the Mosaic Law. In Deuteronomy 14:1, it says, You are the sons of God, of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves or shave a bald spot above your forehead for the dead. Don't do these types of things. Now, we understand that Baal is not a living God, and he doesn't exist. But we also understand that Satan exists. And Satan's demons exist, and they have a tremendous amount of deceiving ability. Now, in this situation, God did not permit any demonic activity to take place. Yeah, Baal wasn't there. Baal wasn't real. Now, we aren't given any look into if this was attempted, if Satan wanted to do that, or his demons, but God stopped it. God was not going to let them do anything. And then in verse 30, Then Elijah said to all the people, Come forward to me. So all the people came forward to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord which had been torn down. Then Elijah took 12 stones corresponding with the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, Israel shall be your name. And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he built a trench around the altar, large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he laid out the wood, and he cut the ox in pieces and placed it on the wood, and he said, "Fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the burnt offerings and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." So they did it a second time. Then he said, "Do it a third time." So they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. There was going to be no misunderstanding where the fire came from. Now, the first thing that's important, and I'm going a couple minutes over, but we'll hurry. Why did Elijah spend time repairing the old altar? He was not going to use the altar that was used for Baal. And any worship of God needs to be done appropriately and done to honor God. So right, by rebuilding the altar in the correct manner, God was honored. And it also shows that the altar had been neglected, torn down. They had been so far away from worshiping God that they didn't care about that anymore. And so God was Elijah was honoring God by worshiping God in the manner that God prescribed. We can't worship God in a manner that we prescribe. It has to be the manner in the worship that He prescribes. And then the trench around the altar held 2 measures, which is about 4 gallons of liquid. Then he filled the trench with water and he soaked the wood 3 times. So there was 12, 16, 20 gallons of water poured on this thing. There's no accidental lighting of the sacrifice. And then in verse 36, after the altar was prepared, Elijah appealed to the Lord and compared this with the manner the prophets of Baal used. Quite a bit difference. Elijah showed a quiet confidence in the Lord. Then at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet approached and said, "Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so that this people may know that you, Lord, are God, and that you have turned their heart back." And then almost immediately. We're not told how long, but it had to be fast. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. Wow. I would love to see a YouTube of that. When all the people saw this, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." Then Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal and not let one of them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. We'll go more on this next time, but what was the people's response? They cried out, "The Lord, He is God! The Lord, He is God!" But we don't see any permanent change in their actions. The northern kingdom of Israel did not change their worship. Ahab didn't change after God's rain of fire. What did they see? I don't know what they thought. But it brings up one point, and this is where we're going to end. Unbelief is not triggered by a lack of evidence. It comes from the suppression of the evidence. And on the flip side of that, belief does not come from looking at the evidence, not that it hurts to look at evidence, but belief comes from the working of the Holy Spirit in our life. As it says in John chapter 1, verse 12 and 13, "But as many as received Him, to them He gave the right to become the children of God, to those who believe in His name." Verse 13, "Who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of a man, but of God." God reveals. It is God who draws. It's not evidence. Evidence is important. Evidence is, we need to understand that. We're not believing something ludicrous. But it's not the evidence. It is being born by the will of God. And boy, I sure like that idea. Let's pray.